eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. We will not be quoting scriptures today because we're taking time out from our ongoing studies to take a look at our founding. And we will begin that after we pause for a few moments of silent prayer, affording you the opportunity to use the time for rebound if necessary and to shift gears into strict academic discipline. Whether we get through this or not depends on how fast I can read. Shall we pray? Father, we are grateful to You for the phenomenal freedom that we continue to enjoy in this client nation. We now pause, Father, to look back upon those who founded this nation, who gave the thought necessary to establish a system in which a client nation could flourish. And therefore, we recognize the fact that Jesus Christ is the one who sustains us. He is the one who provides the wall of fire. He is the one who actually provides us our unlimited freedom in the hostile environment of the devil's world. As we pause to salute individuals, we will be mindful of the fact that it is Jesus Christ who controls history. Therefore, enable us today to recognize these men, knowing that it was the doctrine in their souls that enabled them to come up with the ideas and the concepts which have provided us 235 years of freedom in client nation America. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. Well, it was 235 years ago today, the 13 colonies of Great Britain declared themselves free and independent states. This was with the approval of the representatives of the Second Continental Congress, which met in the Pennsylvania State House in Philadelphia, chaired by John Hancock. The Declaration, drafted primarily by Thomas Jefferson with a few alterations by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, was submitted to Congress on the 28th of June, 1776. On the 4th of July, votes from all the colonies were obtained in its favor, and the 13 United Colonies were declared free and independent states. The Declaration was signed on that day only by John Hancock, and with his name alone, it was sent forth to the world. It was ordered to be engrossed upon the journals of the Congress. And on the second day of August following, it was signed by all but one of the 56 signers whose name is appended to it. The one individual was Matthew Thornton, who on taking his seat in November, asked and obtained the privilege of signing it. Several who signed it on the 2nd of August were absent when it was adopted on the 4th of July, but approving of it, they thus signified their approbation. The signing of that instrument was a solemn act and required great firmness and patriotism in those who committed it. It was treason against the home government, yet perfect allegiance to the law of right. It subjected those who signed it to the danger of an ignominious death, yet it entitled them to the profound reverence of a disenthralled people. But neither firmness nor patriotism was wanting in that august assembly. In their own sound judgment and discretion, their own purity of purpose and integrity of conduct were fortified and strengthened by the voice of the people in popular assemblies, embodied in written instructions for the guidance of their representatives. Such were the men unto whose keeping, as instruments of providence, the destinies of America were for the time instructed. And it has been well remarked that men other than such as these could not have conceived, planned, and carried into execution such a mighty movement, one so fraught with tangible marks of political wisdom as the American Revolution. As the Congress assembled, debated the passage of the Declaration, a bellman ascended the steeple of the State House, later known as Independence Hall. Below at the main entrance was stationed a young boy whose duty it was to signal the bellman if the vote favored independence. The bellman expressed doubt that the gentlemen of the Congress would make the treacherous decision to proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. That is a quote from Leviticus 25:10a, and it is blazoned on the side of what we call the Liberty Bell. Well, all this doubt was removed when the young lad below began clapping his hands and yelling, "Ring, ring." And when the bell tolled, the deed was done. And those whose vote proclaimed liberty had now confirmed the veracity of their cause with a mutual pledge to each other of our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. 56 men put their signature below the text of the Declaration, each of the 13 colonies being represented as declaring themselves free and independent states. Today we will salute these brave and honorable men who put their very lives, fortunes, and sacred honor on the line, and in doing so purchased our freedom, which has been sustained now for 235 years. I have selected 8 delegates to serve as examples of the kind of men who founded our heaven-rescued land. The excerpts will be taken from the 1848 edition of B.J. Lossing's biographical sketches of the signers of the Declaration of American Independence. I want you to keep in mind the reason I'm doing this is we're going back to the middle of the 19th century, not far removed from our nation's founding. I want you to note the vocabulary that Lossing uses, and you will see how well he structures his sentences, and also the vocabulary at times is quite interesting. The first man we will note is from New Hampshire. His name is Matthew Thornton. These are 8 signers of the Declaration, and Matthew Thornton was born in Ireland in the year 1714 and was brought to this country by his father when he was between 2 and 3 years of age. Matthew chose the medical profession, and at the close of his preparatory studies, he commenced his business in Londonderry, New Hampshire. And when the provincial government of New Hampshire was organized on the abdication of Governor John Wentworth, Dr. Thornton was elected the president. And when the provincial Congress was organized, he was chosen Speaker of the House. That was in January of 76. In September of the same year, he was appointed a delegate to the Continental Congress for 1 year and was permitted to sign his name to the Declaration of Independence when he took his seat in November. He's the only one who was actually not at the convention that was permitted to sign. In 1789, Dr. Thornton purchased a farm in Exeter, where he resided until the time of his death, which took place while on a visit to his daughters in Newburyport, Massachusetts. That was on the 24th of June of 1803, and he was then in his 89th year of his age. Dr. Thornton was greatly beloved by all who knew him, and to the close of his long life, he was a consistent and zealous Christian. He always enjoyed remarkably good health, and by the practice of those hygienic virtues, temperance, and cheerfulness, he attained a patriarchal age. The next is someone you know, John Adams of Massachusetts. If you haven't seen the, I think it's an HBO teleseries on John Adams, it's certainly worth the effort to do so. It's about an 8-hour production. And it stresses John Adams' life before, during, and after the presidency. Well, Adams was born in Braintree, which is now Quincy in Massachusetts, on the 30th of October, and this was in 1735, and was a direct lineal descendant in the 4th generation from Henry Adams, who fled from the persecutions in England during the reign of the first Charles, and his maternal ancestor was John Alden, who was a passenger on the Mayflower. Adams's primary education was derived in a school at Braintree, and there he passed through a preparatory course of instruction for Harvard University, whence he graduated at the age of 20 years in 1775. He was admitted as a barrister in 1761, and as his professional business increased and his acquaintance among distinguished politicians extended, he became more publicly active until in 1765, when the Stamp Act was raised, a perfect hurricane in America. This shows Matthew Thornton. I've got pictures of these guys. I don't have his signature. I was able to find signatures of the signers except for this guy. And it may be because he was not on duty at the beginning. This is John Adams. That's the best picture I could find of him. And he really needed a better picture. But the fellow that played John Adams in the movie came close. Okay, but a little bit better looking. This is the famous portrait of Patrick Henry's speech regarding the Stamp Act. Now, it was the Stamp Act that really ripped things, as we'll note later when we get to Benjamin Franklin. But there were a number of things that were called the Intolerable Acts. There were about 10 of them. But the one that really set their gut on fire was the Stamp Act. When you bought certain products, you had to pay a tax were there a stamp on it. And this was something they felt was unjust and therefore had to be met with a little bit of veracity. The concept is that they were being taxed without representation in Parliament. Now, this is a famous portrait here. It's Peter Rothermel's famous 1851 painting of Henry's Stamp Act speech. And you can see this at the Red Hill Museum in Brookneal, Virginia. And I have been there and I have seen the painting. And you also can see it over my desk. But this speech here is what riveted so many of the founders to the fact that independence had to be considered. So he was known as the voice of the revolution. Jefferson's known as the pen of the revolution. So we move forward by noting that there was an essay written by John Adams that contributed to the concept of independence. It was his essay on the canon on federal law. This production at once placed him high in the popular esteem. And the same year, he was associated with James Otis and others to demand in the presence of the royal governor that the court should dispense with the use of stamped paper in the administration of justice. In 1766, Mr. Adams married Abigail Smith, the amiable daughter of a pious clergyman of Braintree, and soon afterwards he removed to Boston. Laura Linney plays Abigail in the movie, and now, as we speak, Gabe Basso is in a television series that is being produced in Connecticut, and he is playing the son of Laura Linney's character. Now, I understand that that series will be on Showtime sometime. I think the first episode begins this September. So we'll keep you advised on that. We understand Gabe is doing a great job. And, of course, you will love Laura Linney and anything that she does. Well, there in Boston, Adams was actively associated with Hancock and Otis and others in the various measures in favor of the liberties of the people, and was very energetic in endeavors to have the military removed from the town. That would be the British military. Governor Francis Barnard endeavored to bribe him to silence, at least by offers of lucrative offices, and they were all rejected by Adams with disdain. Were we to have such, let's call it politicians today, that the bribes would be turned down. Mr. Adams became very obnoxious to both Governors Barnard and his successor, Thomas Hutchinson. He was elected to a seat in the Executive Council, but the latter, Hutchinson, erased his name. He was again elected when Governor Thomas Gage assumed authority, and he too erased his name, and these things increased Adams' popularity. I should note that Barnard, Hutchinson, and Gage were royal governors. In those colonies with royal governors, the number of those colonies grew from 1 in 1650 to 8 in 1760. The crown possessed a mechanism by which to ensure that royal policy was enforced. The Privy Council issued each royal governor in America a set of instructions carefully defining the limits of provincial authority. The royal governors were to have the power to decide when to call the provincial assemblies together, to prorogue, meaning to postpone or dissolve the assemblies, and to veto any legislation passed by those assemblies. The governor's power over other aspects of the political structure of the colony was just as great. So you can see that they were under a little bit of tyranny because they had no representation to assume otherwise. And so we have here these three men who are mentioned in our context. Now, soon after the ascension of Gage, the Assembly of Salem adopted a proposition for a general Congress and elected five delegates thereto in spite of the efforts of the governor to prevent it. John Adams was one of these delegates and took his seat at the First Continental Congress, which was convened in Philadelphia on the 5th of September in 1774. He was again elected a delegate in 1775. Now, on the 6th of May of 1776, Mr. Adams introduced a motion in Congress, quote, that the colonies should form governments independent of the crown. This motion was equivalent to a declaration of independence. And when a month afterward, Richard Henry Lee, Virginia, introduced a motion more explicitly to declare the colonies free and independent, Mr. Adams was one of its warmest advocates. He was appointed one of the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence, and he placed his signature on the document on the 2nd of August of 1776. That committee to draft the Declaration consisted of these five men: Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. It turned out that Thomas Jefferson, as we'll note later, was the youngest of the five, but he was appointed to be the chairman and ultimately was asked to do the majority of the writing, editing done primarily by Franklin and Adams. So Jefferson was given the duty to draft the Declaration. But how this was agreed to was never made altogether clear. He and Adams would have differing explanations, each writing long after the fact. According to Adams, Jefferson proposed that he, Adams, do the writing, but that he declined, telling Jefferson that he must do it. Why? Jefferson asked, as Adam would recount. Reasons enough, Adams said. What can be your reasons? Responded Jefferson. Reason first. You are a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to appear at the head of this business. Reason second. I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. Reason three, you can write 10 times better than I can. Jefferson would recall no such exchange. As Jefferson remembered, the committee simply met and unanimously chose him to undertake the draft. I consented. I drew it up. Possibly neither of their memories served, and possibly both were correct. Jefferson may well have been the choice of the committee, and out of deference or natural courtesy, he may have offered Adams the honor. That excerpt taken from John Adams by David McCullough. Now, in 1825, Adams had the felicity of seeing his son, John Quincy Adams, elevated to the presidency of the United States. In the spring of 1826, his physical powers rapidly declined. And on the 4th of July of that year, he expired in the 92nd year of his age. On the morning of the 4th, it was evident that he could not last many hours. And on being asked for a toast for that day, the last words he ever uttered, words of glorious import, fell from his lips. Independence forever. On the very same day and at nearly the same hour, his fellow committeeman in drawing up the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, also died. It was the 50th anniversary of that glorious act, and the coincidence made a deep impression upon the public mind. The next fellow is from Rhode Island. His name is Stephen Hopkins. That's his signature. There's a reason for it, as we'll note. Stephen Hopkins was born in the town of Providence, Rhode Island, On the 7th of March, 1707, his mother was the daughter of one of the first Baptist ministers of the city of Providence. He early opposed the oppressive acts of Great Britain. In 1774, he held three offices of great responsibility which were conferred upon him by the Patriots, namely, Chief Justice of Rhode Island, Representative of the Provincial Assembly, and Delegate to the Continental Congress. In 1775, he was a member of the Committee of Public Safety of Rhode Island, and he was again elected a delegate to the General Congress. He was reelected in 1776 and had the privilege of signing the glorious Declaration of Independence. The signature of Mr. Hopkins is remarkable and appears as if written by one greatly agitated by fear. But fear was no part of Mr. Hopkins' character. The cause of the tremulous appearance of the signature was a bodily infirmity called shaking palsy. Would that be Parkinson's? My dad has that, and his signature is very much like this now. When my dad was in high school, that was in the days of yore, when part of the curriculum was handwriting, penmanship. And he described to me how they would give you lined paper and you had to make circles, counterclockwise and clockwise, and touch the lines but not go over or under. And this is how you got muscle memory in your hands, one of the exercises. When I was a little boy, I marveled at my dad's signature. Absolutely magnificent. And so I decided that I had to come up with a signature like my dad's. So I practiced and practiced and practiced. I want to get all the swirls and everything that he did in there. We'll see Benjamin Franklin. He was a good swirler. Embellishments, I think, is what they call those. So I practiced and practiced and practiced, and I got my signature down to where I thought it was a reasonable, like 10% imitation of what my dad could do. But you take a look at this. This is how my dad signs his name now. And on top of the fact he's blind. So we had Lou Basso advised us when we moved Dad up here that he should have a power of attorney. I should have one from the state of Missouri to make sure everything was kosher if we needed it up here. And so he drew up a power of attorney contract or whatever it's called, and we went down to his office to sign it. And my dad's signature is legible, but it's very much like this, and he didn't hit the line. Well, he's blind. And so someone asked me on seeing that, and I have to show it quite often, what happened here on this signature? I said, he's blind and he has Parkinson's. And they said, oh. That ended that discussion. So what he has is Parkinson's, and obviously on his right arm, with which he had been afflicted for many years, and which obliged him to employ an amanuensis to do his writing. He died on the 19th of July, 1785, in the 78th year of his age. The life of Mr. Hopkins exhibits a fine example of the rewards of honest, persevering industry. Although his early education was limited, yet he became a distinguished mathematician and filled almost every public station and the gift of the people with singular ability. He was a sincere and consistent Christian, and the impress of his profession was upon all of his deeds. Next, we have Roger Sherman from Connecticut. That's Roger right there, and that's his signature. I've noticed in looking for photographs of these guys what should I say here? I didn't know when they had the best photographers back then. And this appears to be in color. Did they have color photographs? I don't know this. They have color photographs in the early 1800s? Anybody know? They did not, did they? They didn't even have TV. So I don't know. But this is Roger. Let's find out about him. One of the most remarkable men on the Revolution was Roger Sherman. He was born in Newton, Massachusetts on the 19th of April of 1721. In 1723, the family moved to Stonington in that state, where he lived until the death of Roger's father in 1741. Roger was then only 19 years of age, And the whole care and support of a large family devolved to him. He had been apprenticed to a shoemaker, but he now took charge of the small farm his father left. In 1774, they sold the farm and moved to New Milford in Connecticut, where an elder brother who was married resided. Roger performed the journey on foot. Few people can walk from one state to another, but you can almost jump to states up there, those little bitty states. They're about the size of Texas counties. So he went on foot from Massachusetts over to Connecticut, carrying his shoemaker's tools with him. And for some time he worked industriously at his trade there. Now, Mr. Sherman's early education was exceedingly limited, but with a naturally strong and active mind, he acquired a large stock of knowledge from books during his apprenticeship. It is said that while at work on his bench, he had a book so placed that he could read when it was not necessary for his eyes to be upon his work. He thus acquired a good knowledge of mathematics, and he made astronomical calculations for an almanac that was published in New York when he was only 27 years old. Not long after he settled in New Milford, he formed a partnership with his brother in a mercantile business, but all the while was very studious. He turned his attention to the study of law, and during his leisure hours, he was so proficient that he became in legal knowledge so advanced that he was admitted to the bar in December of 1754. Now, in 1766, he was elected to the Senate, or the upper house of the legislature of Connecticut. And it was at this time that the passage of the Stamp Act was bringing the politicians of America to a decided stand in relation to the repeated aggressions of Great Britain. Roger Sherman fearlessly took part with the Patriots and was the leader among them in Connecticut until war broke out. He was elected a delegate from Connecticut to the Continental Congress in 1774. He was one of the most active members of that body and was appointed one of the committee to prepare a draft for the Declaration of Independence, a document to which he affixed his signature with hearty goodwill after it was adopted by Congress. He was a delegate from Connecticut in the convention of 1787 that framed the present Constitution of the United States and was a member of the State Convention of Connecticut, which assembled to act upon the ratification of that instrument. He therefore was on the committee that drew up the Declaration. It says here that he was a delegate to the convention, at which time the Constitution was submitted to the colonies for ratification. And he was also a member of the Senate that ratified the Constitution in the state of Connecticut. So he was a busy guy. That's a big founder right there. For 2 years after the organization of the government under the Constitution, he was a member of the United States House of Representatives. He was then promoted to the Senate. That was back in the day where you were not elected to the Senate. You were appointed to the Senate by the states, for Pete's sakes. Don't remember when we studied that? That is one of the most atrocious amendments to the Constitution that has ever been conceived, let alone ratified. Now everyone gets to decide who is going to be a senator in this country. The legislature should do that. The legislature puts people there that will be favorable to that state. There are even people in our Congress, and I suspect some in the Senate, that don't even live in the state that they are supposed to represent. Well, that's another study, and you can get that on the Internet. But this man here was appointed to the Senate by the state of Connecticut. He was then promoted to the Senate, which office he filled at the time of his death, which took place on the 23rd of July of 1793, in the 73rd year of his age. Next guy is Francis Lewis. He was from the state of New York. Francis Lewis was born in Wales in the town of Llandaff in the year 1713. His father was an Episcopal clergyman. His mother was a clergyman's daughter, so he was a double PK. And Francis was their only child, and made it even worse to be a double PK. He was left an orphan when only about 5 years old, and was taken under the care and protection of a maiden aunt who watched over him with the apparent solicitude of a mother. He received a portion of his education in Scotland, and another relative became proficient not only in his native tongue, the ancient Briton, but in the Gaelic language, then mostly used in Scotland. His uncle, Dean of St. Paul's in London, afterwards sent him to Westminster, where he obtained a good education. Now, you can see that Francis Lewis was a very bright fellow. I would love to see old Francis here get in a debate with, say, Harry Reid. And he was orphaned at five and went to live with an aunt. And then he had an uncle that took up his education. He understood ancient English. They call it Britain. He understood, obviously, English of the day. And he therefore went into this Gaelic business. I don't know if anyone speak Welsh, which is Gaelic, and it's all around in Great Britain. But it's nothing you're accustomed to. So this man is brilliant. He went to St. Paul's. He went to Westminster at the age of 21. He became a possessor of some money, which he invested in merchandise and sailed for New York, in which city he formed a business partnership. Mr. Lewis's business increased, and his commercial pursuits kept him much of the time in Europe until the opening of the French and Indian War, in which he was an active partisan. He was the aide of Colonel James Mercer at Oswego when the fort was captured by Montcalm in August of 1757. Marquis Louis Joseph de Montcalm Gazon. French. But the Montcalm, he's the guy that won the battle over Mercer at Oswego. That was a key battle in the French and Indian War. And in Europe, on the continent, they called it the 7 Years' War, because I guess it lasted 7 years. And Mercer was slain in that battle, and Lewis was carried with other prisoners to Canada. Lewis was sent to France and was finally exchanged. At the close of the war, 5,000 acres of land were given him by the British government as compensation for his services. So he was a POW. 5,000 acres given to him. Compensation. Mr. Lewis was distinguished for his Republican views. That small r has to do with the form of government. Remember when we studied at the very, very, very beginning of the Founding Fathers study, that the concept of the form of government. You don't take the government and remove the people who are in it. What you want to do is change the form. And changing the form, therefore, is done by elections. And then we have an opportunity to change the form of government this coming November. And you can at least put an alteration in the form in November and change the form in November of 2012. That's how it's done here. If you don't like the government, you can change it. And that's our Constitution does this. It's interesting to note that, and I'm sure there are exceptions somewhere, but with regard to our foundational documents, the Declaration and the Constitution, no other society has ever established a means by which to run a country by printed documents. The Brits don't have a constitution. I mean, John was forced to come up with a Magna Carta. That was useful, but it was not something that was used or is used to run the country. We have the phenomenal pleasure and good fortune to have the Declaration and the Constitution that locks in the delegation of powers to three branches of government. The problem that we face today is that we've been invaded by a fifth column. And the fifth column has nothing to do with people, it has to do with thought. And the thought is progressive ideology that came to us from none other than the continent. And these people have come in here, we've studied the Frankfurt School, we've understood the concept of the long march through the institutions, we've studied all of the personalities along the way, and we've seen that progressive ideology is something that's been hanging around for a quite good long while, but that it gained a good head of steam in the 1960s. And therefore, it has progressed quite nicely for them over the course of the last 50 years. Now, we therefore have been conquered in a bloodless coup d'etat by means of thought. No guns were fired, and there was absolutely no invasion of an external army from some far off yonder land. It was simply an invasion of thought, and the thought, therefore, has been infused into the souls of so many through a corrupt educational system that now this thought has the idea that our foundational documents are passé and need to be changed or ignored or simply done away with. Well, that's the circumstance, and Mr. Lewis here was a distinguished fellow for his Republican views. That's a form of government. And he was elected one of the delegates for New York in the Continental Congress of 1765. And when the Stamp Act became a law and non-importation agreements nearly ruined commerce, he retired from business to his country residence on Long Island. Would you please take a look at that? This tax, that's what the Stamp Act is a tax. And this tax had such an impact on commerce, it ruined his business. So he just simply retired and moved to Long Island. We got mad with King George over this. Yet now we're doing the same thing again here 235 years later. In 1775, Lewis was elected a delegate to the General Congress by the Convention of Deputies from several counties in New York. He was also elected a delegate for 1776 by the Provincial Assembly, and he became one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence in August of that year. Now, Mr. Lewis was a shining mark for the resentment of the British and Tories. And while the former possessed Long Island, they not only destroyed his property, but had the brutality to confine his wife in a close prison for several months without bed or a change of raiment, whereby her constitution was ruined and she died 2 years afterward. Did that to his wife. They're all bugs, Wyatt. Having attained to the ripe age of nearly 90 years and honored by the universal reverence and esteem of his countrymen, Mr. Lewis departed his life on the 30th of December of 1803. I want to give you a little bit of information about this Louis-Joseph de Montcalm-Gazon. He was a French soldier who commanded the French army during the French and Indian War. That went from 1754 to 63, and that was between France and Great Britain. Those who were Whigs curbed the power of the crown. Those who were Tories curbed the power of the people, according to Sir Richard Phillips. So you have this mentioned here in this context about the Tories. There were the Whigs and the Tories, and they actually became political parties once we established our nation and started electing representatives and the presidency. This is a comment by Richard Phillips if you want to understand very simply the difference between the two. Those who are Whigs would curb the power of the crown. Those who are Tories would curb the power of the people. Our next guy is John Witherspoon of New Jersey. And this is, I think, where I want to stop our study right now. It's a good place because when we come back in the second session, we will have Witherspoon, we will have Benjamin Franklin, and we will have Thomas Jefferson. And these fellows have pretty extensive dossiers here, and we will pause early for our tea and crumpets, putting us back here at 20 till the hour.